While the loudest battles over Confederate monuments and other symbols of a lost bloody war have gone dormant, the impulses behind them have not. No one is more triggered by the widespread protests to unwarranted extrajudicial killing of black Americans today than the supposed proud sons of the South, which is why it can be exceedingly difficult to focus on the need for atonement and healing, never mind reparations, while this administration relentlessly acknowledges their very fine peopleness, and few of us know what is yet to come. Of course, there is no comparison between the atrocities of Third Reich Germany and today's polarized but mostly peaceful United States. But the impulse toward demonizing political enemies and scapegoating of perceived evildoers among one's neighbors is more than dangerous enough, which is what makes Dr. Susan Nyman's work and her latest book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil, so important. The author joins us now from Potsdam, Germany, where she is the longtime head of the Einstein Forum. Susan, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, pleasure to be with you.
As I'm sure you could tell just now, I, like many others, struggle to find ways to talk about Nazi Germany in relation to the present day. While your focus is on the aftermath of national atrocities, I wonder if you could suggest a credible way to do that without people reflexively turning away.
Well, the interesting thing is that when I first began my research on my book, Learning from the Germans, it was a very provocative title. And Americans were, understandably, who've been brought up with a rather simple picture of Nazi Germany as absolute evil. People were reluctant and, disturbed by the analogy. I must say, by the time the book was published last fall, and I did a long book tour, and we had seen, as you quoted, out of the White House, someone praising Nazis as very fine people, nobody was shocked by my title in that three-year period. And lest we use the word neo-Nazi, I think that's a cheap exit. Those people who were brandishing swastikas, which are forbidden in today's Germany, and torches, and wearing T-shirts with Hitler quotes, and using the expression blood and soil, which is a Nazi expression, that's Nazis. That's not neo-Nazis. Those are Nazis. So that's the first thing. One, thing that I think is, and of course there are all kinds of differences between slavery and the age of neo-slavery, which I think is wrongly called Jim Crow. That's a way of prettifying what actually took place, and you have wonderful work like Brian Stevenson's National Lynching Memorial in Alabama that have showed us just exactly how awful the time after slavery was. But my book begins by pointing out all the differences, and of course there are many differences. You know, no two histories are the same. What most struck me in my research were some similarities, and they were the similarities between most Germans at the end of World War II and people who defend the lost cause. Now, this is really was even quite a shock for me, because it is not something that Germans talk about. They will tell you that their parents were Nazis or their grandparents, and that they're ashamed of them, and that, you know, many places, family structures were really thoroughly destroyed when the children grew up and realized what their parents had done. A very, very, tenuous difficult relationships with their parents. I think because we think of Nazis in a very demonic sort of way, we tend to think that the minute the war was over, they all got down their knees and begged for atonement. But actually, most of them thought they were the war's worst victims. And they would talk about the fact that their country had been partly dismembered, their cities were in ruins and ashes, their men, if they survived, were in prisoner of war camps, the children were hungry, and on top of that, those damn Yankees wanted to make out that it was their fault that the war happened. And what I understood by looking at those litanies is that people, of course, always think about their own suffering first. And the Germans did suffer in the aftermath of the war, no question about it. 7 million people dead, cities absolutely destroyed, about a third of the country lost. So what I think is, it's natural. We all want our people to be heroes. We want our parents to be heroes. We want our country folk to be heroes. And if something happens so that we can't see them as heroes anymore, the second thing we do is to think of them as victims. We say, well, they would have been heroes if they could have, but history made them victims. And you see that move in post-war Germany, as well as still often among a certain kind of Southerner. What the Germans did that was historically unique is to make the further move, which was to say, yes, we fought and we suffered a lot after we lost the war, but other people suffered more and it was our fault. And that's a move that I really think Americans can learn from, because once you acknowledge that you were really the cause of a vast amount of suffering, and you do something to atone for it, it's painful. But what the German people have been going through in the last 40, 50 years has actually made them a much better, stronger, and surprisingly, even a happier country. It wasn't easy. And you know, to my friends in the South, I spent quite a lot of time in Mississippi when I was researching this book, learning from people, black and white, in the South who are trying to work on racial reconciliation and getting people to acknowledge the really painful history of our country. They actually found hope in that because, of course, they know how much pushback they get for asking people to acknowledge unpleasant truths. But when you see that it's completely natural, and that even former Nazis did that for a long time, you can say, well, okay, our country's taking some steps, and of course there are people who push back against it, but we can come through this.
I'd like for you, if you would, because you've given us great insight into why the lessons of Germany have application to present-day America. And even if there is some redundancy here, I wish you would just say to our listeners, what are the key lessons that we need to learn from Germany and through your important book?
So, first of all, the Germans, they like long compound words. So they have a concept which I translate as working off the past or working through the past. And it's not one simple, single process. What it really involves is facing a new and truer historical narrative. Again, we'd all really rather have a, you know, heroic narrative of our country, but it's, you know, just simply wasn't true. So it involves a new narrative, and the narrative is something that needs to be, of course, taught in schools. You know, people need to rethink the way history is taught. And there's a good American organization called Facing History, whose purpose really is to provide materials for a different curriculum about American history. And they're very serious, good people. So if anybody's interested, they should look at their website. It's called Facing History. But education doesn't begin or end in school, as we know. And popular culture needs to be examined as well. We need different kinds of films. We need different kinds of songs. We need to look at the songs that we sing. We need to think about our iconography. And, of course, that battle is taking place in the United States over public monuments. One thing that I think people get wrong about the monuments discussion is it gets polarized into this question, well, is it history or is it hate? I don't think it's either one. I mean, of course, it is history. But we don't memorialize every piece of our history. You know, you don't build a monument to your Aunt Mildred unless she did something absolutely special. You might keep a picture of her in your living room, but we pick and choose the people who we decide to build monuments to. And we pick them because they represent values that we want our children to honor and our communities to respect. And I think once you get that, I certainly understand people who defend, you know, the Johnny Reb statues and everything else by saying, well, I don't feel any hate in my heart for black people. And I believe them. I'm sure that that's true. But what they're overlooking there is that those monuments are not just simple history. They represent values. New Orleans Mayor Landrieu took down those statues in New Orleans, he made a beautiful speech, some of which I quoted in my book. But I think there was one thing he didn't get quite right. He said he thought of the Lee Monument from the perspective of a 10-year-old black girl walking by that statue and feeling he wasn't there to inspire or encourage her, and he didn't want that to happen. And I think that's fine, but I think you need to add, I don't want a 10-year-old white boy walking by that statue and thinking that's the kind of man I'm supposed to be, you know? And that is the message, of course, that little white boys were getting every time they walked by a Confederate general or a Johnny Reb statue. So, you know, rethinking, first of all, which monuments ought to be put in museums, but particularly thinking about who we want to put in their place is a very important part of this, you know, this process. My hope is that, you know, communities will take it on themselves to do this in a most, you know, the most possibly democratic way, small d there, democratic way as possible, and really talk about which values they want their communities to honor in the 21st century. And, you know, that's a way in which communities can both learn about their own history and learn about and, you know, think about values. I was actually born and grew up in Atlanta. And my mother was involved in the school desegregation campaign, so I kind of grew up in the middle of the civil rights movement. But I had no idea when those statues were built until 2015, when people began to talk about them. You know, I assumed, I think like most of us did, well, they were just put up right after the war, and, you know, people wanted to remember their fallen heroes. But of course, it was part of an orchestrated campaign, and that's very important that we learn that. Mm-hmm. So if you are trying to, you know, work through a difficult past. There's not one recipe. You know, even before the virus, I was saying, you know, it's not a vaccine. It's not a one-shot thing. And lately I've been thinking maybe it's like a flu vaccine. You know, it's something that you have to get a repeated number of times, because just simply saying, okay, I acknowledge that much of U.S. history has flaunted white superiority over African Americans and Native Americans in ways that, you know, we shouldn't have done, just shouldn't have done.
We're talking about issues that involve reconciliation and atonement. I'm not even sure that that matters to a lot of the people. There seems to be, in fact, a gleefulness to the tensions rather than the kind of suffering of seeing evil in the conflict rather than in the supposed opposition. It feels like at times the worst is yet to come in this country. What led the Germans to undertake the work of self-examination and of learning from that?
Well, it was a number of things, and it was different in the two parts of Germany. In East Germany, the leadership was really anti-fascist. The East German leadership had survived the war either in exile or in concentration camps. So you had good leadership on one side, largely. I know most Americans don't know anything about that, but it's true. On the other side, it was a question of time. It was a question of, you know, accounts coming out of survivors. People, of course, in the first couple of decades just wanted to repress what they had done. And it wasn't until you had literature, you had movies, there were church groups who were active, some writers and artists. And I think there was a sense of shame when Germans realized how they were seen in the eyes of other people, in the eyes of other countries. That was certainly played a role. And I'm sorry to say, since I do live in a different country, I see how other people have been looking at the United States in the last 4 years, and they are shocked and saddened by the kinds of things that you refer to. There, America has lost, in the eyes of much of the world, lost its leadership function as a place. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, but America's supposed to uphold democracy. What are they doing? You know, we looked up to them for, you know, a long, long time. You know, we do not have national leadership right now that will get us out of that mess.
We're coming up on an election that is already divisive and may take us farther down the road negatively. Is there one lesson we need to learn from the Germans that would help us get into this election and get out of it with some promise?
Well, care about truth. Look at your sources of information. Do not rely on one single source of information. Do not rely on social media. Inform yourself. And do not demonize people who look or think differently from you. I would say those are the most important lessons that we can learn.
Dr. Susan Nyman is a moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and essayist. She's been the director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany since 2000. Her many, many books include Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, and most recently, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Susan, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It was a pleasure.